Take axiom, namely the concept that God moving into creation is creation. God moving into man is man. God moving into nature is nature. Namely, the identity of the creation and its creating power. We also have Hermes giving to us one of the great principles which was later to influence all our knowledge, and that is the great concept of analogical resemblances. Long ago it is said that Alexander the Great, while king of Macedonia, went out into the desert to visit the tomb of Hermes, a tomb which has apparently disappeared from our present knowledge, although there are reported locations for it even now. Opening this tomb, he gazed down upon the great sage of the past, whose body and bones had moved to ashes. But he saw among the ashes the great emerald tablet, known as the Emerald Table of Hermes, which contained upon it the great Hermetic inscription, which opens with the rule or law or statement, which has since become world famous, "That which is above is like unto that which is below. That which is below is like unto that which is above." This parallel created the entire concept of medieval science, a science based upon the similarities of things, the idea of macrocosm and microcosm, that the universe was the great man and man the little universe. And while we have theoretically outgrown much of this thinking, as Thorndike explains it, it is still true that the law of analogy is operating in our lives every day as a force in our thinking, and is also a powerful instrument of scientific research within certain limitations. So the Hermetic concept of analogy stands out in a strange intensity. We can probably trace the thinking to earlier periods and far places, but the statement, the bringing together of the idea, and its clarification, seemingly, was part of the Hermetic tradition. Thus we have analogy and mentalism coming out. We have the Hermetic work emphasizing that a man is what his mind is. That if his mind has experienced its re-identity with God, man is God. That mind, like the later quicksilver of the Hermetist, that mind absorbs all things into itself and transforms them. That it is the agent which can never cease functioning until all opposites have been reconciled. That also that this mental process has a great challenge in life. Man's inevitable and eternal instinct of inquiry arises from the great destined end for which he is intended, namely that man can never rest, never cease his wanderings, never settle into any permanent pattern until he has achieved all that is necessary for the reconciliation of all opposites within himself and around himself. That man is therefore the reconciler, that he is the power that brings heaven to earth and raises earth to heaven. Man in the Hermetic tradition is no longer a toy in the hand of destiny. He is no longer an instrument subject to the machinations of unknown forces. He is no longer a pawn of autocratic deities. Man is the master of both gods and nature, not because of his arrogance as a person, but because he possesses within himself the power of reason. And by the power of reason, all things that are divided, broken, or injured can be brought together and healed. Thus the healing power of unity, the restoration of division, the bringing of all that is necessary to man, and his ability to use it, digest it, assimilate it, and transform it from theory to practice. All these powers rest naturally within the capacity of the individual. The great Hermetic art, therefore, is man's reconciliation of heaven and earth through his own wisdom, through his own reason, through the attributes of his own conscience and consciousness. The Greeks were given to numerous disciplines. They believed in training the mind. They believed in, to a measure, the preparation of the mind for certain experience. They hoped to attain, as the Neoplatonists, illumination above intellect. But all of this was a strange journey homeward. It was man searching for a truth, searching for a reality for the salvation of himself. The Hermetic philosophy shows different principles, and these principles were to gradually emerge and mingle with the later streams of humanism. For in the Hermetic art, man was not only capable of redemption, he carried with him a tremendous responsibility to redeem. He had a job. He had a work. And it was the great labor of his mind to reveal to him his work. One of the purposes for which intellect is given to man is that that man may discover his own job. This is a rather practical way, perhaps a little homely way of saying it, devoid of fine Greek, but it is the principle involved. That man was not here to leave here, as some taught. That his existence in this world was not a penalty for sin. That he had not fallen from a grace into a disgrace. That he was not merely here because he was in prison, and that we all shared a common guilt or we wouldn't be here. Nor was his primary end to escape here, to leave this place, and to return to some far distant land in the terms of Neoplatonism. The real purpose of man was to assert the universal mind over nature. Not as a tyrant, but as a gardener. And in one of the alchemical books of Hermes, we have the Hermetic gardener in the garden. This Hermetic gardener is not there merely to enjoy life. He is there to keep the weeds out of the garden. He has a job to do every day. It is his duty, therefore, to pick the weeds of false knowledge out of the garden of truth. It is his duty to see that good things are well fertilized and well cultivated. It is also within his province to be a kind of Luther Burbank, to be able to improve the qualities of plants. And we have another Hermetic axiom, namely that art perfects nature. In this axiom, which later became one of the outstanding keys of the Hermetic alchemical philosophy, it is assumed that skill in man becomes the skill of God working for all things. Thus the individual who goes forth and improves something plays God, just as the individual who goes forth to destroy anything plays devil. That each individual has the right and the power to have a divine participation in the improvement of things. That it is not his duty, nor his place, to simply wait until deity does all things. Rather, deity expressing its primary power through the potential wisdom of man, deity releasing its own mind through the human mind, forms of all humanity one mind for the accomplishment of its own works. Thus the Hermetic philosopher, if he wishes to assume that Hermes is this mind personified, may well say that this mind is the author of all books, the author and original of all knowledge, and perhaps most of all, the patron of all skill, and that the greatest of all skill is this skill of transformation, this skill of a transmutation by which all things are transformed from a lesser to a greater state by law and by lawful procedures, man becoming skillful then in the administration of natural law, becomes the preserver of his planet, becomes the perfecter of his way of life, and makes possible all other good things, so that not only man but all nature enjoys a wonderful fecundity and prosperity. Hermes tells us, either as the person or as the embodiment, that all things are under the sovereignty of their superiors, and all things are servants of their superiors, and that it is the duty of the superior to guard the inferior, and it is also the duty of the inferior of every level to revere and obey that which is superior. Now, in the concatenations or orderly sequences of nature, man is, hermetically speaking, the chief of the animals. He is the naturally ordained ruler of the life upon the planet in which he exists. He is better equipped than any other creature visible to him for the advancement and common profit of the whole earth. Therefore, man, being superior to the animal, to the plant, to the mineral, to the elemental and chemical organization around him, man's superiority gives him the right of service. It makes him responsible for the security of all these other things. Man has a proprietorship over everything that is less than himself. But this proprietorship is not merely tyrannical authority. This proprietorship is responsibility to serve and improve, advance and increase, unfold and enlarge, strengthen and redeem everything in nature inferior to himself. Now, that was quite a concept for the time. In fact, we're having a little trouble with it now. The idea that man's sovereignty is duty, that because he possesses a certain kind of mind, he is the god of the kingdoms beneath him, and that he must be a just and righteous God, that he has those responsibilities which are similar to those which we assume God has in relation to ourselves. We assume, as Hermes explains, that the deity that we worship is all good, all powerful, all virtuous, all beautiful. Therefore, we bestow our allegiance upon that power, with perfect confidence that it will not betray us. Those kingdoms below ourselves transfer a similar allegiance to us, and in any degree to which we fail to make the common good of these things our primary consideration, to that degree we are false gods in nature. All science in the Hermetic concept only exists for the purpose of equipping the individual for the service to which he was intended. Science is not to give us mastery over nature, but to give us insight into nature. By science, by philosophy, by religion, we are supposed to have the three elements of the philosophic stone, the salt, sulfur, and mercury that must be brought together, and from which comes an elixir of life, a life which bestows the healing of all things because it arises from unity. Here there is appearance that perhaps Hermeticism is indebted to the Pythagorean philosophy. But do not forget that Pythagoras declared that he gathered his numerical philosophy from Egypt at an earlier date. So where it came from directly, we do not know. But whenever Pythagoras referred to the number two, or the duad, he spat upon the ground, on the assumption that it was the symbol of division, and that all division is death, that it is something even sacrilegious to speak the number of division, and those who speak it must cleanse their mouths. Thus all things which separate, according to alchemy, retard the projection of the stone. All growth in nature is restoration, and restoration is reunion. It is the bringing together of things separate, so that in their unity they may find wholeness and wellness and fullness. But as alchemy and the later Hermetists also taught, the bodies of things are not easily brought together. It is not very easy to cause an amalgam of two rocks, no matter how hard you hit them together. Nor is it easy to conceive that out of two separate human beings, the Hermetic androgene can actually physically be created. Physically, things cannot be identical, having a separate existence in body. Therefore, the Hermetists always pointed out that union is not to be attained in body, which, however, is not a misfortune, nor in any way a retarding of the process. Before things can be united, they must achieve a victory over body, because things outwardly not to be united may be inwardly united, which is the strongest union of all. If this be true, though bodies cannot be identical, minds can come into a common union. And out of the compatibility of minds, a unification may take place. And this may in turn lead to the final Hermetic step, namely, that minds are compatible. But as man outdistances mind and elevates himself to a spiritual state, he passes from compatibility to identity. That in a spiritual condition, all things may be one. In mental things, or in mental level, all things may be in agreement, may find common purposes and common good. Whereas physically, all things can only be, as the old masters used to so quaintly state it, in vicinity. That is, close to each other in some way, but not achieving any internal union. Hermes, then, gives us the mind as the wonder worker. He tells us that mind, because it is superior to body, is master of body. That the body cannot be held responsible for any corruption, while it is under the sovereignty of an intellect. Therefore, that all ills, troubles, misfortunes that afflict a body must be blamed upon the mind, which is the ruler of that body. Therefore, that if this mind leads man or permits man to indulge in unreasonable or irrational procedures by which the body is injured, it is the mind and not the body that is responsible. Also, if through its own mistakes the mind has brought the body to mishealth or to difficulty and to sickness, the body cannot remedy the excesses of the mind, and therefore the mind must remove its own negative factor and must reintegrate its own position and must redeem its own conduct before health can be restored to the body. Even then, as mind, in turn, is master of body, so spirit is master of mind. And whereas mind is accountable to the body for certain leadership, it is accountable to the spirit for certain obedience. For all things must obey superiors. Therefore, mind is the messenger, the instrument, the intermediary, and in this sense becomes the Greek Hermes and the Latin Mercury, the messenger of the gods, the winged being that can travel into all spheres and spaces, carrying the words of the gods. Hermes, as the messenger of God, therefore is associated with his concept of Mercury. He is associated with the quickness of this deity. And in the ancient Greek legends, it is said that Mercury was more rapid even than his winged heels and helmet might imply. He was so rapid that he could circle the world in the twinkling of an eye. Mercury was therefore the universal immediacy of mind. And also this Mercury could not be held in any restraint or limitation. It penetrated walls, it went through solids, it did all kinds of things, being apparently possessed of the most superhuman attributes and powers. Obviously, again, referring to mind, that knows no distance and no limitation except that which it imposes upon itself. Thus, in the story of mind, we have this power that can travel, can be anywhere, can be the armchair traveler who, sitting quietly beside the fire, remembers the distant lands that he has visited, or thinks of other distant places that he reads about in books. This mind can also escape from now into past and future. It can escape from all kinds of patterns imposed upon it by dogma, limitations, and creedal separateness. It can most of all, if it is so minded and so inspired, attain to the free circulation of its own state. It can be itself, totally and entirely. And in being itself, it is free of everything except the duty which it owes to those things less than itself. And in the natural nature of its own being, it becomes the useful and inevitable servant. Even Hermes was aware that there is nothing more dismal than unemployment, and therefore that the mind, escaping from the burden of ignorance with the duties and employments which it bestows, does not escape into free space merely to become a vagrant, merely to wander around thinking about things and enjoying thought of itself forever. The mind, having escaped from unprofitable labor, chooses profitable labor. Having departed from unworthy procedures, moves victoriously into worthy ones. Thus the mind can never be idle. It can never rest. It must always move, and in its motion, it must always be adventuring toward the solution of mystery. Hermes then points out that there is no mystery, except the mystery of ignorance, and that everything mysterious is merely something not understood, and that it is the end of mind, that there shall no longer be mystery, that there shall be no question that is not answered, no riddle that is not solved. This concept Hermes carries also to another level, namely the power of mind in the sense of its imaging propensity, that the mind is not only capable of perpetuation and self-discipline and all of this type of thing, it is capable of a procreative process. In other words, mind is capable of giving birth. And in the description of this process in the medieval Hermetic tracts, we find many things that could well be attributed to an earlier date. The idea of the creation of the Hermetic androgy, the mind as father and mother of itself, the mind as a kind of Melchizedek, a priest forever, and that the power of the mind to create between its own positive and negative polarities, or its male and female principles, brought together through what the alchemists call the Hermetic marriage, that from this is born the homunculus, or the crystal being, the infant that is made of glass, born within a womb of glass, and like Merlin, possessed of all kinds of magic. This homunculus is the symbol of man's innate creativity. The mind is not exhausted, either in learning or beholding or administering. The mind is not exhausted in the perpetuation of knowledge. Its final function is not to take that which has been known, become aware of it, and pass it on as that which shall be known. This does not exhaust the power of mind. The power of mind includes the possibility of a direct creativity. And it is because of this creativity that the world does not remain the same. It is because of this creativity that the world is not merely the same kind of a garden forever. It is because of this same creativity by which the skilled gardener can improve the quality of plants, so man can improve the quality of self. And furthermore, he can creatively project from the known, creating within himself tremendous instruments of imagination. These instruments of imagination have to have a validity. Imagination is not the individual actually freely generating something from nothing. Imagination is not merely a conjury of a web of insubstantial fabric. There can be no creativity without law. There can be no procreation of mind unless the image, the created thing, the new creature, is lawful. Thus, although the mind may engage in flights of fantasy beyond our conception, we have the extraordinary record that the fancies of one generation are the sober facts of the next. At the time, a novelist of the quality of Jules Verne's wrote some of his wonderful books about trips to the moon and journeys under the sea and around the world in 80 days. Everyone thought him mad. They said his creativity, his imagination, approach insanity. Yet these things are now sober facts. And down through the ages, countless dreams that have never had substance in their own time became the basis of the mature growth and development of the race, or of the tremendous social pattern to which we belong. In all things, therefore, Hermes points out, there is a lawful creativity in mind. We can imagine nothing that has no relation to a fact. We may imagine a disproportion of things. We may build a daydream about futures we will not live to see. But the only reason we create this dream is because we have already recognized a need for something more than we have. We are merely projecting both our processes and our necessities. Therefore, we are bringing together, procreating elements, and fashioning them into a new vision. If this vision takes the form of More's Utopia, or Campanella's City of the Sun, or André's Christinopolis, makes little difference. There is nothing essential in these great social visions of the 17th century which have not since been realized. Yet in their own time, they existed only in the creative power of the human mind. The creative power of the human mind may also formularize. It may not only have certain abstract thoughts, but it may weigh and estimate needs so exactly that it can create solutions immediate to problems imminent. This means that certain minds have the power to go beyond the common acceptances and to achieve certain things. There were thousands and thousands of good parents who realized in an abstract way the need of their children's education. They knew that there had to be a way to bring essential knowledge to the young. But from among these parents, Amos Komensky, or Comenius, came forth with a creative concept of an exact method, and that method has given us the modern public school. These things existed as dreams first. These dreams are sometimes handed on from one to another before they are realized. But dreams realized now or later, according to Hermes, belong in the fact that there is a creative dimension in the mind. That the mind not only buffets itself against the necessities of nature, but is forever ingeniously solving the unsolved problems of its own necessities. This mind, then, carries still further implications. And on this ground, Hermes approaches that section of his work which is essentially religious. Hermes now identifies this mind with a series of situations. And he produces what is called the great hermetic confusion, inasmuch as he presents to us a concept of God that is monotheistic, polytheistic, and pantheistic, all at once. He intended to. Actually, when he created a monotheistic concept, he did exactly what many ancient peoples did. And when he created a polytheistic concept, he did no more than the Trinitarians did in the early church, when they made of God three persons. Actually, no difference was achieved. And pantheistic, with its implication on the divinity of natural beings, also did not depart from the concepts of the Greeks, the Egyptians, or for that matter, much of our modern thinking. If there is a tendency to religion in modern materialism, that tendency is pantheistic. It is not so named or so distinguished. But science, with its tremendous exploration of energies and its discovery of ever-increasing power throughout nature, has gradually come to take an almost reverent attitude towards elements and substances and essences and principles and laws, regarding these as innumerable powerful agencies which it would like to control, direct, and use for its own purposes, whereas Hermes says the answer is to use them for their own purposes, which is something a little beyond us at the moment. But Hermes does give us a monotheism, and in this he is not different from most other ancient peoples, for it is a great mistake to regard either the pagan or the heathen as essentially a polytheistic believer. Although we may have gods by the thousands in ancient and oriental pantheons, these peoples are essentially monotheists. For monotheism is not primarily the existence of only one divine person in nature, but of one divine principle in nature. That principle being reality, truth, or God. That this one divine power manifests solely in itself, by itself, and through itself, and has no dependency upon its own creations for the expression of itself, is scarcely reasonable or logical. The most devout person today believes that he is a spark from the flame of God. He sees no conflict with his monotheism in affirming that there is a divine principle within himself. This principle within himself must be divided from other similar principles in other selves, but all of these are suspended from one common principle, the great fire from which all the sparks have come. That great fire is the one deity. The sparks are the polytheistic expressions of that deity. And nature, every part of which is filled with the life and power of God. The innumerable sparks in the atoms, in the blades of grass, in the rocks, in flowers and animals. These sparks are pantheistic in the sense that they represent God growing up through nature. They represent this one power. A medieval man denied the power in himself or the divine principle in himself to all other creatures less than himself. But today, we are not inclined to take this position. We recognize that growth is the manifestation of life, that anything that can grow is alive. We further recognize that existence, the continuance of a thing without disintegration or decay, is also the proof of the presence of life. Therefore, all things which have a continuance have some kind of a life. Even dead bodies have some kind of a life. And therefore, this life, which is a continuance of existence, or is an animation in existence, with growth, with motion, with power, this life must either be God, or else there is a life in nature apart from God, which Hermes would not accept. Consequently, we live in the substance of a monotheism. As human beings, divinely ensouled, we are polytheism. And as we gaze out to the infinite vista of the presence of God in all universal mysteries, we are in the midst of pantheism. Yet these things are not essentially different. They do not contradict each other, in spite of the fact that much has been made of this apparent hermetic contradiction. It is not a contradiction because it is an unfoldment upon levels and is no more unreasonable nor unorthodox than the statement of Paul relating to the thrones, dominions, powers, principalities, angels, and archangels. A recognition also of the existence of secondary powers of a divine origin but superior to man. The Hermetic tradition binds this entire problem together by placing over the universe a kind of being representing the extension of divine consciousness into nature. This medial being suspended twixt heaven and earth, dominion-wielding, is the concept of universal intelligence. Intelligence is less than God and more than nature. Man, likewise, is less than the totality of God and more than the totality of nature. Man has powers above nature, but he is subject to powers beyond himself. This median power is the instrument by means of which the sovereignty administers the world. This power is intelligence, wisdom, knowing, learning, or reason. Man has become peculiarly, by his position, the embodiment of this reasoning agent. Everything above man has a faculty beyond reason. Everything beneath man has power or faculty less than reason. Therefore, as man ascends, he moves from the reasonable to the intuitional, to the inspirational, and to the illuminal. As he leads downward from reason, he goes down into instinct, into sense, and into attributes of reflexes and sensitivities which he cannot really understand. Thus man possesses this reasoning power. This reasoning power, however, is also in motion of its own accord. The power of reason is not forever the same. The power of reason, apparently, is subjected also to a kind of growth. Reason moves upward, as all other things in nature. And this motion of reason is clearly set forth in the vision of the Pyamandris. This motion of reason is also indicative of man, for man is gradually moving through reason, from its least to its greatest parts, even as he is moving in philosophy, from Theosophia Practica to Theosophia Theoretica. He is moving upward from objective, obvious things to things more real but less obvious or less objective. This motion is his natural growth, and this motion is the releasing of his power to act as an intermediary between heaven and earth. For this reason, Hermes and many other hermetists and mystics do not accept the idea that man is simply an animal standing on its hind legs. Nor will they accept the famous old Platonic definition that man is a biped without feathers. There is something more to this than meets the eye. Man is divided from the kingdoms beneath himself by a quality which these kingdoms possess in potency, only to a limited degree. In the animal, reason is potential. And to certain animals, the rudiments of apparent reason or manifesting reason may be dimly traced. But man is the only creature, the only reasonable creature, that can build an empire. He is the only animal that can wonder where it came from and wonder where it goes. He is also the only animal that can look at the sky and determine to conquer it. Man has proportions and dimensions within himself, a great uneasiness. If this uneasiness was in the beast, he would have taken the world away from man. But because man possesses this uneasiness, possesses this constant pull, and is moved toward the continuous improvement of himself, man is gradually learning the magic of his own mind. He is learning, however, that this mind is governed by law. He is learning that this mind is something for which he is accountable. That unlike the concept of modern humanism, he is not lord of all he surveys to do as he pleases, but only to do what must be done. He has the right to do as he pleases only because he has the power to do so. And in having this power and exercising this right, he does that which is contrary to law. He falls into adversity. And here we have the hermetic concept that what we call the tragedy of the world, the tragedy of life, the misery and misfortune with which we have burdened our own kind, is man exercising or attempting to exercise a kind of free will which is without foundation in value. If he continues this exercise, he may do as he pleases for a time, or within a certain pattern, but the laws which he has violated will turn upon him and destroy him. He is not merely a mind in vacuum. He is not the type of being conceived by doing. He is not the person for whom all the world is his oyster. He is not the individual for whom all the world is a slave. He is not merely here to gratify. And while he attempts to follow such a procedure, he is in trouble and will continue to be in trouble. He is here primarily to understand, to become the hermetist, to become the alchemical master. He is here to learn the secret way by means of which all imperfect things may be redeemed, including himself. He is here for the purpose of becoming the master of the hermetic arts. The capacity to play God to nature, even as he bows humbly to the God of nature. He is therefore exercising toward a divine state. And it is because of this reason within himself that man has creatively projected the concept of deity. Deity, in its own inevitable existence, is unknown to man. Man's only possible assumption is that it exists. Man cannot define it without defiling it. But man instinctively recognizes the total sovereignty of something. And this is partly due to the fact that he instinctively experiences the potential of the total sovereignty of himself. Therefore, that phase of mind in which all things are possible becomes a very interesting thing. The question was once raised theologically, and this is a nice point. Does God perform miracles? There was a great question over that problem. A number of theologians affirmed that because he was God, he could perform miracles. Another group said no. The mere fact that God is God does not permit him to perform miracles. Then the third group came forward with a very pithy quotation from Scripture, which sort of settled the argument. They said, frankly, there is no need for even a speculation as to whether deity can or cannot perform miracle, because it is stated in the Scripture that with God all things are possible. Therefore, where does miracle come in at all? If God can do anything, then there is no problem of miracle, because the all-doing of God is of the nature of God, and therefore not miraculous to God. And as he can do everything and anything, there is no requirement of an action beyond his common nature. This was a very interesting point of argument, but it is very reminiscent of our Hermetic problem. For Hermes envisions this kind of a deity, in whom no miraculous or exceptional action of any kind is necessary. For the common works of God are themselves sufficiently miraculous. There is no requirement for man to consider that he lives in a universe beyond law. There is no assumption that he lives in a universe ruled over by any temperamental or eccentric factor. For in this universe, universal mind, moving into its own creations and becoming identical with them, moving forever, moving into all parts of its own nature, and establishing itself in the midst of itself on all levels, becomes the kind of alchemical garden, where it is stated by the Hermetists that the seed of immortality is present in everything. The alchemists declared clearly that they cannot manufacture the elixir of life, the philosopher's stone, or any great thing. They can only take the seed of it, which is present in everything, and help that seed to grow through art. Thus, by art anticipating and advancing nature, Hermes would have said this, Universal mind is locked in everything. Its lesser expressions are the habits and forces peculiar to various types of life. Its greater expression is the reason within it. Its greatest expression is the consciousness within it, which is the master of all its reasoning processes. Therefore, it is not that man shall create these things, or shall exercise a strange and mysterious power, unique, but that man represents one kind of God serving another kind of God, one condition of deity administering to another condition of deity, and that the mind with which man saves life is the same mind as is in the life which he saves. Therefore, all processes are deity working upon deity. All creatures are God manifesting among gods. And over this sovereignty is mind. Therefore, all things are attainable by mind because mind is all things, in all things. And the various operations which we call nature may be understood because the very understanding by which they operate is identical with our understanding by which we understand the operation. This goes into many abstract phases of metaphysics, but it does give us certain clues and certain keys, and I think constitutes the essential burden of the general phase of the Hermetic literature. It cannot be rescued from a single book. It cannot be taken from any one group of fragments. It must be taken from 1800-year survey of the existing changes, modifications, and specializations within the descent of this tradition. But because these things are in it, and because men of many ages, including the fathers of modern science and philosophy, were aware of this tradition and many of them were addicted to it, we find its principle surviving in our thinking and through us, whether we realize it or not, will survive to the world of the future. So I think that perhaps is a good point to bring it to a termination this evening before everyone gets a little too exhausted with that part of the divine mind which he is using.